The Exxon Valdez ran aground, ripping a large hole in the vessel. 6 million gallons of oil have already poured into the water.
I can't stand to see that much fish and birds and all of our resources, natural resources, going to hell.
People are mad as hell about how we treat our environment, and they don't want to take it anymore.
We will make the 1990s the era for clean air.
Rapid climatic change is likely or possible over the next century.
In order to heal the planet, we will have to start changing our lifestyle in some very fundamental ways.
This is an American Agenda radio special. Clean up the environment, sure, but not in my backyard. Here is ABC News correspondent Hugh Downs.
In the next 5 days, you'll probably hear the word environment more times than you have in the past 20 years. Sunday, people throughout the United States and around the world will take part in Earth Day. The events range from a rock concert in Rio to a drama competition in London, from a grassroots cleanup of Chesapeake Bay to a parade of garbage trucks in Oregon. Everyone seems to be in favor of cleaning up the environment, but it's not that easy. It can cost a lot of money, and it means sacrifice on everyone's part. What we want to find out from you in the next hour is, are you willing to pay more money in taxes and in consumer costs to make our planet a cleaner and greener place? What personal sacrifices are you willing to make? And what sacrifices are you not willing to make? The cynics have a name for this, NIMBY, standing for Not In My Backyard. To explain, here is my ABC News colleague, John Stossel.
April 22nd, 1970. More than 20 million people marched, sang, and generally got into ecology. It was the first ever Earth Day. And on that spring day, even Richard Nixon was an environmentalist.
I think that 1970 will be known as the year of the beginning, in which we really began to move on the problems of clean air and clean water and open spaces for the future generations of America.
Now Earth Day celebrates its 20th birthday. But some people don't want to be invited to the party.
Earth Day is mostly hype.
That was environmentalist Barry Commoner. In many ways, America is much cleaner today than it was on Earth Day 20 years ago. Some rivers and lakes have been brought back to life. Tons of soot and noxious gases have been taken out of the air. Of course, the world could be much cleaner. We got the lead out of our air thanks to lead-free gasoline, but a record 21 billion tons of carbon dioxide entered the atmosphere in 1989 alone. And there are new concerns. Destruction of the tropical rainforest. Holes punched in the Earth's cancer-shielding ozone layer by the chlorofluorocarbons in spray cans. And the still hotly debated greenhouse effect.
Public sentiment about the decline of our nation's, and indeed our world's environment, have reached a critical point.
Deborah Callahan is with the group Americans for the Environment.
Americans are ready to alter their lifestyles, to spend more money, and to make a few sacrifices to clean up our environment.
Maybe they are. We took a random, unscientific sampling and asked just how much would Americans be willing to sacrifice. For instance, are you willing to take the time to sort your garbage to recycle paper, aluminum, and glass containers?
I don't particularly think I'd like to do that. It's a waste of time, I think.
It's too much effort. You know, when you throw things away, you throw it away.
Okay, how about this one? Would you give up your car to cut down on auto emissions and use mass transit instead?
That would work, yeah. I don't do that. It's easier to use my car.
It takes a long time, sometimes waiting for the bus.
Okay, well then, Mom and Dad, how about giving up those wonderfully convenient disposable diapers that fill up the landfills? Why not go back to cloth diapers?
No, probably not for the convenience of it.
Modern times has allowed us to use better things, and why go back to the primitive when you have these new things?
What if your city wanted to open up a very useful waste recycling plant or a sewage treatment plant near your home?
Too messy.
If we're going to start smelling up the area, I wouldn't want one.
I wouldn't like that because I think the value of your home would go down.
I mean, no one wants to live next to a sewage treatment plant.
So who will make the sacrifices? The environmental groups say we must make them now. Michael Oppenheimer of the Environmental Defense Fund.
The debate isn't over whether the Earth will warm. The debate is over how much it will warm and how fast.
But other scientists say, wait a second, the data isn't in yet. Remember that some years ago, environmentalists also said we'd have to ban flush toilets by 1974. And Look magazine on the first Earth Day said people in cities will be wearing breathing masks in the 1980s. I don't know who's right, but while they argue, I'm separating my garbage for recycling, and I won't use spray cans. Still, if you try to take away my kids' disposable diapers, I'll put up a fight. Hugh?
Thank you, John.
It's not easy being green.
You're listening to an American Agenda radio special. Here once again is ABC News correspondent Hugh Downs.
That, of course, was Kermit the Frog you heard back there, who's an expert on being green. And nowadays, green has become the byword of the environmental movement. Jeremy Rifkin is the author of The Green Lifestyle Handbook.
We're talking about a crisis that's unparalleled in human history. We have literally affected the biochemistry of a planet with global warming. And it's not an accident or bad luck. It literally is the bill for our industrial consumer way of life.
Global warming, the greenhouse effect, ozone depletion. What exactly are we talking about? Well, Ruth Kaplan is here. She's the executive director of an organization called Environmental Action, a lobbying and education group that was formed by the organizers of the first Earth Day in 1970. Ruth Kaplan, welcome. And what is global warming?
Global warming is a reflection of man's upsetting of the natural balance. Before the Industrial Revolution, we had the sun radiating heat to the earth, and that reflecting back into the atmosphere. There were some gases in the atmosphere that kept all of that radiation from going out into outer space. Some of it was retained in the earth's atmosphere, gases like carbon dioxide, and that kept the earth at just the right temperature for life.
Because enough could get out through the
carbon. Enough could get out through so that you wouldn't have too much heat, and yet some was retained so that it was just the right temperature for life to form and flourish. What has happened is with the Industrial Revolution and the use of fossil fuels in particular, there has been a tremendous increase in the amount of these gases that have been released into the atmosphere, and more of the heat has been trapped. And that is what we're worrying about with the rise in temperature.
And that's the so-called greenhouse effect, because meaning like a greenhouse gets warmer inside because the sunlight comes in and warms it, and it doesn't radiate all of it out.
That's exactly right, yes.
It could happen. And under severe conditions, that could be really disastrous for the Earth's surface, I understand.
Scientists today are talking about increases in temperature of 5 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century. And if you look at that kind of temperature increase, you have very serious effects. You have changes in the distribution of rainfall. You have loss of productive areas for growing food. You have an expansion of the oceans and a flooding of coastal areas. These are just a few of the effects that are anticipated.
How do you answer people who say that since the temperature has not gone up really by a severely measurable amount, that maybe you're saying the sky is falling when it hasn't begun to fall?
Over the last 100 years, there has been an increase in the temperature, and scientists would tell you it is marginally statistically significant. That means that, yes, you should take this quite seriously. There is more gases that are being put into the atmosphere that are expected to further heat. There is no scientific dispute about the mechanism of global warming. The dispute is over how fast and how much.
Right. Now, we're going to take a commercial break right now, but for those of you who'd like to take part in this discussion, we have a toll-free phone number for you to call. If you've got a pencil handy, write it down. It's 1-800-562-3384. I'll repeat that in a second. And when we return, we'll be talking to our other guest, who's a key player in what's perhaps the most infamous not-in-my-backyard case ever. That phone number is 1-800-562-3384. You're listening to an American Agenda radio special. Now, you remember the garbage barge? That ship full of trash that nobody wanted? In 1987, the garbage barge became a symbol of the growing problem of trash disposal. For weeks, that barge floated around out at sea, homeless, with nobody willing to accept it.
We don't know what kind of tropical vermin is in that garbage. We don't know. It's been sitting in the sun for 6 weeks. The safety and the health of the people that live in this county are my first priority.
That was how Claire Schulman felt about it. She was the borough president of Queens, New York. The garbage on that barge was from the town of Islip, New York. And Frank Jones is the town supervisor in Islip. Frank, where did the garbage finally go?
Well, Hugh, after 88 days of sailing on the sea, it came back to New York City. It was offloaded in Brooklyn, burned in a Brooklyn incinerator, and the ash was trucked out to Islip, where we deposited in our landfill in Islip.
Now, the town of Islip, I understand, is involved in another environmental controversy, and that is that you build a composting facility that is good for the environment, but they say that it smells really bad. Is that
we were getting odors on and off, sometimes so bad that you couldn't go out of your house, you couldn't open a window, people were getting nauseous and ill.
Ron Kersen lives near the composting center, which is located right next to the Long Island Railroad Station, and he says that commuters really get a whiff of the problem in the morning.
These trains sit there all night and collect the odors in the cars, and apparently they pull into the railroad station, and having been closed all night, the doors open, and the commuter has no choice but to get into these cars. And the comments that I heard were, I get to work, people look at me like, what's the matter with you? Don't you bathe? Why do you smell so bad?
Frank Jones, is it really that bad?
Well, initially, I think there were some problems. We do have a compost facility that's probably the largest in at least the United States. We're handling some 70,000 tons of yard waste each year. Initially, when the grass was brought in the plastic bags, and if the bags weren't open for the first 2 or 3 days, they sat inside the bags and cooked, as it were, so that when you opened the bags, this tremendous smell came out.
But this is a case where you're really trying to do the right thing. Is this a case of NIMBY, not in my backyard?
Well, it's probably a little bit of that. The people who are affected by this are also affected by this new Long Island Railroad Station, which has brought 2,000 cars a day into their neighborhood. So they feel as though a lot of things are being put in their backyard, and I think this was maybe the straw, the proverbial straw that broke the back.
What are your plans to do something about correcting this?
We've spent a year on it, Hugh, and we've had extensive studies. I think if you would question some of the people now, you'd find that the odor is less. We need to compost. We've got to be self-sufficient in handling our garbage, and we as government officials have got to figure out how to do that in a way, and we think we are on the track to do that on a way that isn't offensive to the neighbors in the area.
And that may be a model for other towns facing the same problem down the line. Frank Jones, town supervisor of Islip, New York, and Ruth Kaplan of Environmental Action are here with me. We want to hear from some of you now. First from Jerry in San Diego, who wants to talk about the Industrial Revolution. Jerry, you're on. Jerry, you hear us? Well, Jerry's not on. Maybe we can find out from Alice in Waukegan, Illinois, on recycling, voluntary recycling. Alice, are you hearing us?
The only solution is immediate voluntary curbside recycling. That is, if every single one of us today would, on our garbage day, take the newspaper, stack them up, and bundle them, and take a pink bag and put the aluminum cans in right alongside our regular garbage, that voluntary people, the Cub Scouts or even just their street people, would pick up these things and recycle them. All of us are too lazy to take it to the center, but we could do that much and probably cut the garbage today by one third. Also, I think you need voluntary backyard composting everywhere, or park sites. They can make big circular fences, and we come drop our grass clippings in there.
Okay, Ruth, Alice seems to feel that we've all got to do it and not leave it to the officials. How do you feel about that?
I think it's very important that everybody does their share, but it does make the whole system work better when you have the cooperation of your own town or city government. Because if you have, along with a garbage truck coming to pick up everybody's waste, if you also have a municipal truck that's picking up the materials to be recycled, then you're sure that it's going to be a program that will reach everybody. So I think that while the voluntary programs are very important, it's more comprehensive to have the municipalities involved.
So it's actually got to be a symbiosis, doesn't it, between the two entities, I guess, the individual citizen and the government.
That cooperation really helps, yes.
Right. John in Houston would like to talk about celebrity supporters. John, you're on.
I certainly believe in conservation, and I do everything that I can, but I'm often troubled by it. Lately, I've been seeing just many celebrities speaking out for this cause, and these are the very celebrities who move to beach houses, who move to areas of the wilderness, destroying our wilderness areas, and these are the celebrities who drive limousines, and then they come on television and tell us about our wasteful lifestyle, and it troubles me that many of these people who are speaking out the environment seem to just be spokespeople and aren't backing it up with action on their own.
We're going to be talking about celebrity supporters a little later in the program, so stay with us, because that is an interesting thing. I don't think all of them are guilty of maintaining a lifestyle that is inimical to what they are preaching. Rosemary in California wants to talk about glass.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi. Am I on?
You are.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
I would like to see more glass back into the market. I would also visualize you in the future. Our homes will probably be built with pipelines where we will be able to put the glass in a certain container. It will go into a pipeline automatically into the street, just as our paper. But it's up to us as consumers to profit from what we call garbage. It's not really garbage if we're going to recycle it. I would look forward to be able to, as we save our aluminum cans, I would like to see the consumer put a few pennies in their pockets and alert those out in big business that this is what we're looking for now when I go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
If I can recycle it, I will buy it. If I can't, I won't buy it.
Don't buy it. Frank, what about that? What about glass, which ultimately becomes sand?
Well, it is. And glass is an easily recyclable material. There is a market for the glass. We in Islip are building a new recycling facility in which we will probably end up grinding the glass back down to sand and use it in our road construction to a number 6 or number 8 aggregate sand so that we can use it in our drainage and road construction projects. Clearly, glass is one of the easily marketable materials.
Excellent. A poll in USA Today says most Americans are willing to recycle newspapers and soda cans, but they're not willing to make greater sacrifices, like driving less. Now, how far will the world's leaders go to reduce pollution? Right now in Washington, D.C., government officials from around the world are taking part in a conference on global warming. And President Bush is speaking there. Our John Bascom is covering that conference, and he joins us now from Washington. John, what is the administration saying right now about global warming?
Well, Hugh, the Bush administration still believes the jury is out. Some scientists are convinced the planet, of course, is in imminent jeopardy, and others aren't so sure. The president has been emphasizing those differences, saying what we need are the facts. Basically, the U.S. is telling the other nations here at this conference that we need a lot more research before jumping feet first into new, probably expensive technologies.
Now, are these world leaders generally ready to set up a timetable, though, for doing something about the greenhouse effect?
Well, not out of this conference, Hugh. I think any timetable will be sort of graduated. The U.S. already has announced a goal of eliminating all chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, by the year 2000. But a total plan of action on the greenhouse front, I suspect, Hugh, is still some time away.
John Bascom in Washington, thank you very much. Ruth Kaplan, I want to ask you that he mentions on the certain types of pollutants, but not carbon dioxide, which I take it is a major offender when it comes to the greenhouse effect or global warming.
That's right, it is, and there are things that can be done right away to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the environment.
Such as?
Energy efficiency, not wasting energy. Getting energy to work more efficiently for us. You know, we've saved almost $1 trillion because some of the energy efficiency measures we've already put into place in this country.
And that probably means that much less carbon dioxide from burning hydrocarbons and so forth for energy.
That's exactly right. We need to pass legislation to have more efficient cars and trucks. President Bush is talking about studying global warming and opposing a bill to have more efficient cars and trucks. That's not the kind of leadership we need.
What is your personal opinion about that delay of studying more? You know, we keep studying and studying. Might we arrive at a point where we look back and say, boy, we really should have got started a while back?
We're at that point already. We should be starting immediately. It's an insurance policy against future disaster. We need to take out that policy today.
And we're talking about what you are willing to do to clean up the planet as we approach Earth Day 2 this Sunday. The environment is literally a cause célèbre.
If we don't do something of environment, to hell with the rest of it. It doesn't mean anything. We're not going to have any air. We're not going to have any water. We're not going to have any fish. We're not going to have any birds. The cost means nothing.
That was James Garner. TV and movie stars are taking center stage during this week's Earth Day events. Ted Danson and Chevy Chase are among them.
And we truly are at risk of not being able to pass on to our kids what our parents passed on to us.
This is the single most important cause that confronts us and our children and their children.
Environmental concerns are now being raised on TV shows such as 30-something and Murphy Brown. And listen to this scene from the film Lethal Weapon 2 as the hero is about to bite into a tuna sandwich.
Tuna?
Daddy, you can't eat tuna.
I can't eat what?
Dad, you're flipper.
We're boycotting tuna, honey, because they kill the dolphins and get caught in the net.
It's having an effect. Just last week, the major tuna companies announced that they're going to stop using tuna that's caught in a way that endangers dolphins. But some people think that the concern of celebrities may not be genuine. One such person is Bob Hattoy of the Sierra Club.
It's okay for a celebrity to do a TV commercial on recycling and global warming, and that's good, and they should be applauded for that. But then when they, you know, jump into their chauffeur-driven limousine and take their private jet to New York to have lunch and then fly back to their house where they bought a mountain and bulldozed the top off and built a 40-room mansion that uses as much energy as a small village, I mean, there's like a problem there.
This is a point made earlier by one of our callers, Ruth Kaplan of Environmental Action. Earth Day is supposed to be a grassroots movement, I imagine. And how do you feel about help from celebrities?
I think that they're citizens of this country and this globe and are very concerned about the environment. There's lots of causes that they could get involved in, and there's genuine concern among people. And there's a real consciousness raising going on out in Hollywood and looking at ways to change their own lifestyles as well.
So it really helps. And many of those doing it are quite sincere and aren't supporting lifestyles that are...
They're going to meetings and they're learning about environmental problems.
Right. Let me ask both of you something. Is it possible that some overly alarmist views of a dozen, 15 years ago, caused some harm? I remember somebody saying once that the poisoning of the oceans was causing the phytoplankton to be unable to return free oxygen to the atmosphere, and that in a matter of 40, 50 years, we'd all be choking to death for lack of oxygen. That kind of statement, it wasn't quite accurate, and could that do harm?
Well, I don't think that there's been an overemphasis on the solid waste disposal crisis that exists, at least in the northeast part of the country. And no question in my mind, we on Long Island, our water supply is underneath the land we live. It's the only water supply we have. We don't have reservoirs or rivers. We can no longer continue polluting that, and that's a real problem, and it's reaching crisis proportions.
So and you feel there's been no overstatement of the problem?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, right. Well, that may be only in certain areas where there was overstatement. And now it's almost any statement is something that has a little more air of legitimacy to it, I suppose. Let's get to add some more calls here. Mike in California wants to talk about the ozone layer and the hole in it. Mike?
I have a question. I have a feeling that some of this is being blown out of proportion. I was listening to a scientist speak yesterday, mentioned that there's been measurement of the ozone or the hole in the ozone layer only for the last 5 years. How can we establish proof that it didn't exist prior to this time?
There's a good question. Do either of you want to answer that, Ruth?
In fact, we're finding not just an ozone hole in the Antarctic, but we're finding ozone depletion in other parts of the globe as well. And this is what we need to be very concerned about. So that, yes, there may have been a natural phenomenon already going on in the Antarctic, but it's increasing, and not just there, but around the globe.
Is it fairly established that it's caused by chlorofluorocarbons?
Yes, it is.
That the major cause of it, in other words, what it... I had heard that one of those molecules can do in millions of the regular oxygen molecule and change the ozone layer.
Yes, there's been further confirmation of that.
Robert, Los Angeles, and the responsibility of manufacturers. Robert, you're on.
My comment question is, why is it that the manufacturers of all these various different pollutants, whether it be gasoline or disposable diapers, why is it that they are not held more accountable for their product after it's been used.
I don't know. Might they be beginning to be held more accountable? What do you think's happening there, Frank?
Yeah, I think most municipalities and state governments are calling for, if not state, federal legislation in terms of perhaps value-added taxes, certainly in terms of the packaging that the manufacturers use, so that the products begin to be manufactured in material that is recyclable. You've got to be able to close that loop. You've got to be able to manufacture material that can be used, that can be reused, and there has to be a market for that reuse, and you've got to close that whole loop of recycling.
Mm-hmm.
States are taking more and more active role in terms of regulating what industry is producing. For instance, in the solid waste area, the six Northeast states, the governors have introduced legislation to control the toxic substances that are used in packaging. So we're beginning to see much more leadership at the state level.
Now, Mark in Bronson, Texas, wants to talk a little bit about the recycled goods and the prices. Mark, you're on.
Okay. It seems to me that companies that use recycled materials to make their products would be paying less for their raw materials. In some cases, they might not be paying anything. But when you see the finished product in the store, like recycled writing paper, for an example, it's going to cost more than conventional writing paper. And it seems to me that it should be costing less, and that would even encourage more people to use the recycled products.
Might that eventually happen, Frank? Do you think where the price would be more attractive to the consumer that was environmentally responsible?
Yes, it can, and again, it goes back to that closing the loop thing, having the manufacturers begin to address their manufacturing methods toward recycling. Newsprint, for instance, you can take a news plant that produces that uses virgin wood to produce the newsprint, and you could add a de-inking process in the front end of it, and use recycled newspapers to produce the newsprint that is now used. New York State is voluntarily, the five biggest publishers in New York State by 1995 are going to 25% recycled paper in their newsprint, which is a major move forward.
If we went to that figure, what would that mean in terms of respite for forests and paper mill plants and the effluent from them?
Hundreds of thousands of acres of woodlands are destroyed, yes, yeah, because of the newsprint.
You have this this composting plant near you. David in Pittsburgh wants to talk about compost. What do you want to ask, David?
Primarily, Frank, what I want to know, I was involved in initial research back in the 60s of recycling of solid waste. Excuse me. And we found that in the compost we had was a very high grade of compost, and yet we flooded the market with it in the area we were in. Now, were you doing anything else with the compost besides just using it as a compost?
Well, right now we are offering it free of charge to our residents who take it back and put it in their gardens and in their yards. And we are in the process of finding a commercial user, a major nursery or two, who will use it, package it, and sell it. Because, as you say, it is a very rich compost material that can go back into the yards and is totally organic.
This is why education is so important on these issues, as the public demand begins to increase for organic fertilizers, then we'll have more of a market for it. The same thing with the newsprint. As the demand goes up and there's a larger market, the price will begin to go down.
We have Kent from Huntsville, Alabama. Kent, you're on.
Oh, hello, Hugh.
Hi.
I've just been listening to the program, and I've just got a comment. You know, I believe the man that was talking about the compost, that's a local project. We're going to have to do things locally. These people that go to Congress with the American people want this and the American people want that, I don't know them from Adam's house cat, and they don't know what I want. And whenever someone goes before making that kind of a wide-range generalization, usually they've got some grandiose idea for spending my tax money. Now, that's
an interesting point. I'd like our guest's comments on that balance between the local approach, which has more attraction, I think, to people.
Well, clearly, I think the lesson of the garbage barge, I've called it the Paul Revere of garbage, is that you've got to solve your local solid waste problem locally. You're not going to be able to ship that problem to Ohio or Pennsylvania or some other place. So clearly, I think the problems do need to be solved on a local level, but there's got to be some higher intervention in terms of manufacturing and requirements for packaging of materials so that we're not inundated inundated with materials that we can't recycle or reuse or in some way turn back into the stream.
Right, and you can't send the garbage to Congress either.
No.
Red in San Diego, you're on.
Hello, Hugh. I'd like to talk about a couple things. Actually, in terms of garbage and compost and sewage sludge, they tie in. But the two areas in which we could pretty much solve our problems in terms of energy and air pollution is if we were to use hydrogen fuel, we wouldn't have any air pollution. And if we would put ourselves on a program to convert to hydrogen fuel, the byproducts of burning hydrogen is water.
Yeah, water.
And
how do you propose to get the energy to separate the hydrogen and oxygen?
Solar energy. We have lots of solar energy available, and we could basically make this country self-sufficient in terms of energy. And one of our biggest problems with our trade deficit is that we're importing energy, and we could be making our own if we'd be willing to invest. And it's an investment, but we would be investing in the plant to make our own energy. And let me just carry on a little bit about compost and waste and sludge. There's a company in Albuquerque, New Mexico that has a process that can make hydrogen out of sewage sludge and garbage and stuff like that. I don't remember the name of them, but that would be somebody you should talk to or we should be aware of. I think it's Phoenix, but I'm not sure.
Let me ask Ruth Kaplan, is there anything moving on that, or anybody seriously moving toward a hydrogen economy?
What I'm hearing so much is talk, and I think so far is talk. I think it's very important to look into it. I think the Department of Energy, for instance, should be investing in looking at what the barriers are to a hydrogen-fueled economy.
Right. Congress did something last month. It approved a tougher clean air bill. While the bill is being debated, was being debated, hundreds of West Virginia coal miners came to Washington to protest.
We feel like the legislation that's on track right now will cause utilities to switch from Midwestern high sulfur coal to low sulfur coal and put myself and my 400 buddies out of work.
But perhaps the problem goes beyond not in my backyard. Here's what Peter Dykstra of Greenpeace has to say.
One of the real hazards is having an Earth Day message that tells each individual, you are the problem. We're all part of the problem, to be sure, but we don't want to let the major polluters and the inert individuals not doing anything in politics get off the hook.
Ruth Kaplan of Environmental Action. Are we seeing more environmental public relations than environmental solutions?
We're certainly seeing a lot of environmental public relations from the corporations. When you have a corporation like CSX that's doing the Earth Tech Fair trying to say they're environmental, at the same time they're lobbying against measures on the Clean Air Act that would protect people from toxic waste, that's public relations. When you see people in their own communities getting together to make a difference about the environment, that's commitment. And there's a lot of that going on in Earth Day 90. I think it's very important that people not think that just because some of the corporations are trying to get on the bandwagon that there isn't a lot of very, very positive action that's going on. Environmental Action is doing a clean motion campaign to get people out of their cars, onto bikes, and to walk, and to use public transportation to help save our planet from global warming. There's lots of good things like that going on.
But it's kind of good to have these watchdogs, though, that aren't going to let corporations or individuals get by with thinking, let George do it, in effect. We got a call from Jim in St. Paul on fossil fuels. Yeah, Jim?
How are you?
Good.
I'm going to make a fairly serious indictment for both Congress, most of your oil companies, and your auto industries.
Go ahead.
And I think something the public ought to hear. And that is the fact that we've heard lots of stories over the years of where it has been possible to make tremendous energy savings with extremely fuel-efficient automobiles and engines. Yet, I've heard five or six stories myself year after year where these things get suppressed and just suddenly disappear. I do not think, as much as there is a lot of public relations going on, I do not think that the people that are in power, both industry and in Congress, are really that serious about saving the environment.
Are they moving in that direction, do you think, Frank?
Oh, I think so. I know there are concerns about how swiftly the government is moving, but it's been clear to me. I've testified before Congress. It's clear to me that the environment is on the top of the agenda. And while not everyone will agree that the Clean Air Bill passed is the best Clean Air Bill, everybody says our air is going to get cleaner over the next 10 years because of the Clean Air Bill.
We've had totally unacceptable foot dragging, both by Congress and by the administration. They've tried to cut back the auto efficiency standards that we had in place, and they are not supporting the current auto efficiency bill. I think the caller is right on, and we need people like him telling their Congress people that they won't accept anything but strong support.
Terrific. Greg in Orlando.
Yes, I think that we don't have to necessarily give up the use of coal. I think what we should be building are MHD generators where you don't burn the coal. You get a high temperature, you turn it into what's called a plasma or ionized gas, send it to a magnetic field, produces electricity, and there are a few operational one of these, for instance, in the Soviet Union, and it's far cleaner than just burning the coal.
Ruth, what do you think about that?
That's an important technology. What it does is allow us to get more energy out of every ton of coal that we burn. We know that we can't give up all our fossil fuels overnight. We need to use them as efficiently as possible to get as much energy out of each unit of coal as we can.
Yeah.
And so this is a good technology. It should be pursued.
Yeah, but according to our caller, the coal wouldn't be burned in the way that we... it still has to undergo combustion?
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
What about stack scrubbers? We used to hear a lot about them. Is it practical to just trap all that, above all, carbon dioxide and particulate matter?
You can't scrub carbon dioxide.
No,
you can scrub your sulfur dioxide. The best way to reduce carbon dioxide is to burn less, and that means energy conservation, energy efficiency.
Right. Al in River City, California.
If each family had 10 acres of land to compost and were required to compost and plant their own food, less packaged foods would have to be produced, less waste packaging would reach the dump site, less shelf preservatives would have to be used in the food, the health of the nation would improve. The fact that land is held by a few landowners with people crowded into cement buildings with no space to naturally recycle the waste and to grow and recycle their own food. Nature can handle it, but when people are required to not recycle and compost, much of the waste is generated in the cities by city dwellers.
Okay, Frank, what about that?
Well, I live in a community where we have quarter-acre lots. We're suburbia. We're not city. We're a suburban community, but we have 3,000 people per acre. So that concept would be difficult to fulfill. I think we've got to live with the realities of how we need to supply food and other commodities to our people, but we also have to look at reusing, recycling, and reducing the kinds of materials that we are throwing away.
Just one last thing in about 30 seconds that we've got here. I'd like to ask each of you, are you generally optimistic about our chances for saving ourselves and that we'll get the will and get up off our hind legs and do something about it? Or do you ever get overwhelmed with an apocalyptic feeling that the limb we're out on may have been chopped off? How do you feel about that, Ruth?
I think it's very important that we don't underestimate the solution. It's not just simple things that we need to do. Some things are more difficult. Sometimes it means taking on powerful corporations to create change. I think we can do it, but we should take on a real challenge.
Frank?
With respect to solid waste, garbage, I think we can be self-contained. I think that each community can take care by recycling, reusing, and resource recovery facilities 100% of their own garbage. I think that's possible.
Well, let's hope we're moving in that direction. I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I want to thank my guests, Ruth Kaplan and Frank Jones, and all of you who called in. I'm sorry we couldn't get to more of your calls. Americans have said loudly and clearly that they want a cleaner environment. We'll just have to wait and see if the Green Revolution continues once the parades and the concerts and Earth Day TV specials are over. For all of us at ABC News, I'm Hugh Downs.